from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely.
If we're
absolutely
uncomfortable talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. I'm Jay Moran. We have a nice treat for you coming up here for the next hour. With us, Jaman Dunn-Danger. Jaman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
A lot to talk about. First of all, I want to say I probably just had the liveliest 20-minute pre-interview I've had during this program. We have a lot to get to. Jaman is... A queer African-American conductor, vocalist and instrumentalist based here in Buffalo. On Friday and Saturday, you're going to be conducting, right?
Yeah.
Joshua's Boots from Adolphus Hailstork. I'm not totally familiar, but why don't you tell us about Adolphus first?
Sure. Adolphus Hailstork, I always chuckle because when you go to Wikipedia, they give you people's full names, and his full name is one of those names that just kind of commands attention. His full name is Adolphus Cunningham Hailstork III.
Whoa.
So it's just one of those names. So, but he is an African-American composer. He's been around. He just turned 84 last month. In April, and he's based in the Virginia Beach area. He's a former professor. He has his doctorate. It's Dr. Hailstork. Very prolific composer, very prolific. Unfortunately, not as recorded as I believe he should be, as much as others believe he should be as well. I would say, so he's actually from New York. He was born in Rochester. Hmm. And I believe he was raised between Rochester and Albany, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
So, and he actually mentions spending time in Albany. A couple of his works, he writes thinking about the cathedrals he sung in Albany as a young boy. He wrote a piece for strings called Sonata da Chiesa, which is he wrote thinking about sort of this time that he spent there. But he is, every conductor sort of latches on to certain composers that they just want to interpret all the time. And he's one that the second I found him, I was like, I can't look away. I have to do as much of his stuff as I can.
And maybe a little bit of a spoiler alert that you don't want out, but you want to record all of his music.
Yeah, I do. That is the plan. Whether it be, full large works for orchestra and choir, stage works, as well as his chamber things, as well as some of his solo things. Like I personally, as a baritone, want to record Behold, I Build a House, which is a piece he wrote for baritone and marimba. So he writes a lot of wonderful things for not necessarily traditional instrumentation groupings. However, they are fantastic all the same.
I'm interested because when it comes to classical music, I most certainly can say I appreciate it. We have a right about 5 feet behind me, we have a classical music radio station here, of course. But at the same time, it's interesting to hear that you say that you are drawn mm-hmm. to his music right off the bat. Explore that for me. What took you in about his music?
I introduced myself to composers sort of, and not necessarily, I don't know if this is a way other people do it,
sure.
But a lot of times when you're in the field, I know a lot of my colleagues tell me I was introduced to such and such composer through class, or I set out to study this work because people like drew my attention to it. I will put on music by composers I don't know and then go about my daily life.
Okay.
Like maybe I'm doing, housework, or I'm washing the dishes and I have my headphones on or something like that. And his work to me has this beautiful blend of rhythmic intensity and lyricism that honestly the only other composer right off the bat that that is more of a composer known to general classical musicians that I think would fit that bill is Maurice Ravel. So it's a rhythmic intensity to the work, but also a lyricism that just cannot be cannot be ignored, and it can't be overstated either.
So Joshua's Boots.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to know about this piece?
Well, this is an opera, first and foremost. It's an opera in one act with a prologue and five scenes. Libretto was written by Susan Kander. This is a work, and one of the things I love about Hale Storck is that he doesn't shy away from writing about the things that are central to the African-American experience. And this opera is one of those things. Joshua's Boots, I don't want to give the whole thing away because I would love for people to come see it. But Joshua's Boots, I'll talk a little bit about the prologue. A young man is introduced, but before he's introduced in the prologue, his mother and siblings are, you know, sitting around a table. They're trying to figure out what's going on. It's dinner time, and yet their father and their brother aren't there. And they're singing to each other. The mother is like, okay, you know, the kids are like, I want to go outside and see what's going on. And the mother's like, you're going to stay in this house right now. Now, it's probably important to mention that the year that this is set in is 1878. So, and they are in Tennessee. So that might tell you a lot of backstory that you would need to know about why the mother is very anxious for the kids during dark to not be outside of the house. They also mention they see a fire on the horizon, and suddenly Joshua runs in and tells them that a group of white men came and lynched his father. And that's the first thing you hear in this opera. That's the first thing that happens. And it is one of those things that, you know, it just kind of smacks you in the face if knowing about lynchings and knowing about what occurred in the United States, not just the South, by the way, lynchings happened in the North as well. So what occurred in the United States at that time, like, you know, it's central to African-American history to know this, but if you either hadn't been exposed to it or it's not something that you, you know, were taught for one reason or another, I won't digress there, but if it's something you weren't taught for one reason or another, it just kind of hits you in the face. And, you know, this is 1878, so the Civil War has officially ended, and, you know, the 13th Amendment, after the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment actually declared that the slaves were now free. And Joshua is around 18 years old, so Joshua is old enough to have been born a slave and then set free, right? And so he and his father were, his father owned this leather shop where they, you know, they created leather and harnesses and reins and things for horses. And so they worked with horses. And the story that Joshua tells his mother is that the white men came in screaming, saying that, you know, free enterprise didn't mean that the black owner could lower his prices for the benefit of the consumer, and those prices be lower than the white owner selling the same thing down the road. And so the white owner grabbed a group of people and said, we need to do something about this and do away with this. And so their decision was to lynch Joshua's father and to burn their place down. And so the plume of smoke that the mother and the children see is actually the shop being destroyed. And the mother, fearful for Joshua, as Joshua tells her that he was overtaken with emotion and just threw his chisel at the first one he saw and ended up cutting them, she knows that if her son stays there with her, the likelihood of him also dying has increased tenfold. And so she sends him away to find a new life because she hears that people are moving to Kansas, and that Kansas is a possibility for a new life. And one of the lines that she says in this prologue that really grips you and lets you know what she's dealing with is, he says, Mama, I gotta go. And she says, yes. And then she says, where can such a black man go? before she tells him Kansas. And then he moves on to Kansas. And then the opera gets underway as to Joshua's journey. What happens in Kansas, what he encounters, who he meets, what happens, it will be saved for those of you that come to see the amazing opera that is Joshua's Boots. But it is, it's a really central story to the African-American experience in this country. And it's something that, you know, people like to pretend sometimes that 1878 was so long ago and slavery was so long ago and, you know, these things have gotten better. And what people don't realize is that, you know, if you build a house on quicksand, it is not going to last, such as the house that you build on a solid rock, right? And so people think that things have gotten better. You can renovate a house all you want, but if it's built on quicksand. So that's really something that's really central to this opera. And the opera, I will say, for those of you wondering, the opera does have a happy ending. It does have a happy ending.
Okay.
So, but I will not tell you the why or the how. That is up for you to come and enjoy. Also with some very fantastic people singing, very fantastic props, fantastic costuming. The staging is fantastic. A few students of mine are actually singing in it as well. So it's just a wonderful project.
Oh, we have to give props also to the conductor, right?
Oh,
of course. Right?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That brings us to that interesting element that, again, I can appreciate. And I think most people can appreciate what goes on in classical music, what goes on in an opera. Mm-hmm. But the conductor's role is something that is obviously so central to the performance. Mm-hmm. At the same time, for most people, not understood at all.
No. And that's fair. That's fair. It's so much easier to understand something when you can see the action and understand what the action is. So like, for example, with a vocalist, okay, this person is opening their mouth and sound is coming out. They've trained to do this. I know what's happening. Instrumentalist, same thing. Conductors, a lot of our work is done behind the scenes. The other funny thing about it that people sometimes don't think about is that I always tell every ensemble I work with, for one reason, what kind of ensemble it is, whether it be orchestra or choir or whatever. I say, look, remember, I don't make a sound. They've come to hear you, to see you, to experience what you have to give them. What I am here to do is to help serve the music and serve you so that we can present something for the audience to then, you know, take in and then sort of decide, you know, how they feel about it. So basically, I think of it sort of this, sort of like a sieve. The rawness of the notes on the page are thrown at me, the conductor, and then it is my job to take time to interpret what the composer was going for, you know, what was happening in their life at the time, why they wrote this, are there words accompanying it, you know, what are all of these things that are important or not important, which instruments are going to, it's going to be harder to hear because of the way that the instrument is constructed. Who do I have to ask to play softer? Who do I have to ask to play louder? Okay. Is this an extremely rhythmic place in the score where I need to be able to give clear cues so that people don't get lost? Now, granted, in general, I should be giving clear cues all the time. However, in some more lyric places, it is more on the conductor to create the shape of the music. But in more rhythmic places, it is important for us to be traffic cops, right?
Okay.
So I do all of these things behind the scenes to the audience because it happens in rehearsal. No one's there in rehearsal. It also happens when I do private study at home and I'm looking at my score and I'm, you know, doing the research on the composer as well. And that way, when we get to the concert, when we get to the performance that the audience has come to hear, I am just assisting. My teacher, Bruce Hangen, at Boston Conservatory, he had a phrase for this. He said, as a conductor, you should always strive to be a servant leader. And that's what I am.
So many interesting parts to your answer right there. You said understanding and knowing what the composer was going through at the time that this was written. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about Dr. Hale Stork's mindset, what his life was like when he wrote Joshua's Boots?
I know for a fact that in general, because he, so this was commissioned, this was a piece that was actually commissioned by a couple of commissioning organizations, one of which was the Opera Theater of St. Louis. So composers will occasionally, well, not occasionally, I should say, composers often work on commission. And so, you know, you commission a piece and then they write a piece. I do not quite know why he wrote this piece at this time.
Okay.
However, I can tell you that it is part of a series of pieces that he wrote that really, you know, shine a bright light on parts of the history of the United States that aren't necessarily talked about in music as much as they should be. So if you think about it, music is always, you know, music and art are always mediums that should reflect things of the day. Whether it is, you know, sometimes you'll see music reflecting political upheaval. You'll see it reflecting, you know, cultural changes, etc. If you think of Shostakovich, you know, and basically his lifelong fight with the KGB, if you look through that lens at all of his symphonies, for example, it gives you a completely different outlook than if you just look at them as what we call absolute music. The thing with this is this piece, he wrote a choral cantata named Crispus Attucks, which is about the first casualty of the Boston Massacre, which a lot of people don't necessarily learn was African-American as well. He wrote several other pieces. One other piece that he wrote that's actually more recent is A Knee on the Neck, which is a requiem he wrote right after the murder of George Floyd in 2020. And so he wrote this requiem, which has since been premiered based on that as well. Another work he wrote, and this is the one that actually inspired me to look at Joshua's Boots and these other works, was his Second Symphony. Doesn't have a program attached to it per se, but the second movement specifically he wrote after visiting Ghana and seeing the holding pens for slaves before they were shipped to the United States during the transatlantic slave trade. And I talked to him about this because I had the pleasure of meeting him in 2022. And at that time, I did actually his Second Symphony, funnily enough, with Buffalo Opera Unlimited through a program we did that year called Spotlight on Black Composers. And he talked me through his thinking of the symphony, you know. He said, you know, you think of the first movement as sort of like, you know, terror in the night. And it starts off with this very like, you know, very soft sound of high strings that is like abruptly cut off by like a very loud chord and trombone. So it's very harsh. The second movement, as I said, is reflective of this experience he had in Ghana. Third movement, he said to me, he said, the third movement is kind of like, okay, you got us, we're here, and now here we are. And the third movement is very sort of jagged in its rhythm, and it's very confrontational, but it's but you can feel the through line through it. And then the fourth movement is an idea of the triumph of the African-American people over these, you know, obstacles and over the adversity that we continue to experience on a daily basis. And so talking about this symphony with him inspired me to look at these other pieces. And so I use that lens when I look at these other pieces so that even if I don't exactly, even if I can't exactly say, okay, he sat down to write this and was thinking this at this exact time, I know that this is a through line based on conversations I've had with him personally of these pieces, and so I attribute it to those.
As a conductor, you've used the term traffic cop. Mm-hmm. You'd be a bit of a traffic cop. You do, like you said, you're doing your work in rehearsals and your notes. At the same time, traffic cops know that accidents and crashes do happen,
yes,
don't they?
Do.
So
yes,
they might happen on stage.
Yeah.
What's that like? What is that experience like? And I guess part of it is not letting the audience know that it's happening, mm-hmm. but at the same time, for the sophisticated follower or whatever, would they be able to pick up on what's going on?
I tell people all the time, you know, I shan't give away all my secrets. But
we've got an hour.
No, but when things happen in concert, the biggest thing is for, you know, us to remain calm, there's nothing to get up in arms about. Okay.
But at the same time, you're pumped. Exactly. This is a performance. Everybody's out on edge.
Exactly. But it's live music. That's the beauty of live music. Sometimes things happen that you don't expect. And so the mark of a really great conductor is the ability to flow with that and allow that to be a part of what is happening in the moment. You have to be able to surrender yourself to the moment. And then it becomes very easy to say, okay, this may not have happened the way that it was supposed to. Don't think of it as fixing, but how do we adapt so that we continue to tell the story we're trying to tell and the audience doesn't go, oh, I don't think that was right, so to speak, right?
Sure.
And sometimes that requires doing sort of artful gestures. Sometimes it means doing very deliberate gestures or making comments. Like, obviously not audibly, but, you know, but like mouthing things or pointing or doing things. I personally, and this has been told to me, so this is not me saying it for myself, but I've been told that I have very expressive eyes and a very expressive face. And people always know when I'm cueing them because my eyes get big like saucers and then I cue. So if somebody comes in at the wrong spot, and it's even happened in rehearsals too with the opera, you know, during the beginning rehearsals and things, if something happens, I'll just kind of, you know, look at who I need to look at. Sometimes I will show them something that I won't tell you what it is so that people don't try to find it, but I will show them something that lets them know that they're not quite in the spot we need them to be in and to either wait or continue. And it's, you know, and it's like I tell people in opera with so many moving parts, specifically in opera, because you have people on stage singing, you have the orchestra here, and you have blocking, which is something you don't have to deal with stage performances generally. And I tell them all the time, I say, okay, look, here's the thing. I am here to keep track of everything happening. If I give you a cue or something of that nature that you don't think is right in this setting alone, ignore what you think is right and follow my cue. Because the likelihood that I am cueing you either early or late because of something else that has happened elsewhere that you are unaware of is 99.998%. So please go with my cue because it is my job to keep everything moving smoothly. And if you don't go with my cue and you think you know what's happening better than I do, then we start to run into train wrecks because then it means you don't trust me and then it means you can't, you don't trust me to do my job correctly.
And those eyes probably get even bigger, right?
Yeah.
I'm interested in maybe your own self-judgment of your performance or your work as the conductor when it's all said and done. Are you more interested in the technical, that we hit all our cues, that everybody was where they should be at the time, that it all laid out according to the vision? Or is it that other part that, like you were saying about live performance, live music, that somehow it all comes together in a certain way that is beyond expectation?
It's the second. I tell people all the time, I have heard technically perfect performances and I have been bored out of my mind. It's not because the notes are wrong. It's not because the rhythms are wrong. It's because it is missing that human component. When things happen, you have to be able to go with the flow. You have to be able to say, okay, this may not be what I intended, but this is what's happening and what the audience is experiencing now. Who am I to tell them that this is not the right experience for them? So how do I now flow with this to keep going? You know, I've heard people get upset about things that aren't technically correct. You know, I always tell this because this is a choral thing that happens sometimes. I tell people all the time, if you are in a choir that is singing a cappella, which means, you know, there's no accompaniment whatsoever, and you have perfect pitch and the entire choir slips out of pitch but are still harmonically together, do you sing the right note or do you make yourself wrong with everybody else? The answer is you make yourself wrong with everybody else.
Wow.
That is the answer. That is the correct answer. Because sticking to what you know the pitch to be, which is correct, creates more problems because now people are worrying about how to get back to a pitch center as opposed to performing for the audience in front of them.
We are talking with Jaman Dunn-Danger. He'll be Jaman will be conducting Joshua's Boots on Friday and Saturday at First Shiloh Baptist Church on Pine on Buffalo's East Side, 7:30 on Friday, Saturday at 2:30. We're going to talk more about the piece, more about Jaman, and more conversation ahead on what's next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media and PR.
The headlines don't stop. The world keeps moving, and through it all, you need news and information you can trust. That's where we come in. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. Same station, same trusted journalism, just with a new name. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered, from Group Chat to Friday Night Lights, from What's Next to the BBC, we bring you the stories and smart conversations that matter. No spin, no nonsense, just the perfect mix of news, information, and entertainment. Listen anytime on the BTPM Listen app or btpm.org.
Hear, Hear, live music in Buffalo, New York is your guide through the melodic pulse of the city. Get a VIP behind-the-scenes look at the broad collective of vibrant festivals, historic venues, and mind-blowing artists that take the main stage and make Buffalo, New York the music destination it is. Listen to Hear, Hear, hosted by Bentley on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. and Saturdays at 6:30 p.m. on 88.7 BTPM NPR.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'm Jay Moran, joined by Jaman Dunn-Danger. Jaman will be conducting the opera Joshua's Boots this Friday and Saturday at First Shiloh Baptist Church here on Buffalo's East Side. I'm really curious because, you know, we talked at the top, of course, you identify as a queer African-American. And you were born in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And your father was a pastor.
He is a pastor.
He's present tense, very good, of course. So you grew up on gospel music.
Yeah.
How did the interest in classical come about?
I love telling this story because it's a very millennial story and very much not what people expect. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, surely you heard somebody do this or you did this or XYZ. No, this is what happened. How old was I? I might have been 6 or 7. We bought a computer. It was a compact Presario. Don't ask me how I remember this so vividly. It was a compact Presario. You know, I still remember the commercials. Compact. Has it changed your life yet?
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, compact Presario running Windows 95. And if you remember at that time, Microsoft had a lot of these sort of, you know, package program deals where they kept, like, you know, sending out things such as Encarta was like one of them. You had different things. And so there was this CD called Microsoft Musical Instruments. Okay. And so it was a CD that sampled quite a few instruments. And to be the 90s, I was really happy to see non-Western instruments in the software. So that was really cool. But I listened to a lot. And the great thing about it is this program, you know, you could click on an instrument. It would give you a little blurb about the instrument. It would give you one sound option where you can listen to sort of an excerpt of the instrument playing as a solo. And then it had an ensemble setting where you could click on the instrument in different ensemble settings. Okay. And, they were all like maybe 15-second clips. They weren't very long, and maybe not even 15 seconds. But I was like, okay, let's listen to this. Let's see what's going on, you know. And I went through all of them, and I just kind of stuck to the violin.
Hmm.
And the violin solo excerpt, like solo unaccompanied excerpt, was the prelude from the E major partita. It was the first one of the E major partita by Bach. And so I heard that, and I was like, oh, this is great. And I was like, I love this. This is great. And I said to my parents, I was like, I want to play violin. Now I'm 7 years old, and I'm like, I want to play violin. And like most parents of children that age, they're like, okay, let's see how long this lasts. I don't want to spend money on something that then is going to go gather dust somewhere. And so my dad goes, okay, well, we'll see. And he told me later, he said, I told your mom. I said, okay, so we'll see how long this lasts. And so I asked and asked and asked for a year. And then the next year, my dad was like, okay, let's see what we can do. He talked to the my elementary school music teacher. There was a company called Quinlan and Fabish, who still exists, I believe, in the Chicagoland area. And they rented instruments. And so my teacher told my dad, he said, yeah, it's not very invasive, the monthly cost. Okay. And my dad was like, okay, let's do this. And so I started playing violin, and I quickly outstripped everybody in my class doing it. By the next year, there were 8 people originally that started violin that year. The next year, there were only 4. Right. The year after that, there were only 2. And by 6th grade, I was the only one. So, and I was just like, yeah. And my teacher told my parents, they said, he goes, there's nothing more I can do for Jamon. Jamon has like gotten to the point where, we need to think about higher level instruction. And so they go, okay, so what do we do? And so he gave them a list, and I ended up starting at the Merritt School of Music, which still exists today in Chicago, a fantastic nonprofit music program. And that's pretty much where my eye was opened to to classical music sort of as a larger thing. Because up until that point, I had just been really concerned with violin. I had just been trying to, do my scales, play these little etude things I was doing. But I started private lessons, and I started playing in, the larger program Merritt had. And I auditioned for the tuition-free conservatory and got in. And then I started playing an orchestra. And then it just kind of went off from there. And it's funny because, a lot of people ask me, when did I want to become a conductor? And that's a separate story. And it's actually not at all related to me playing the violin. It happened when I was 8. And I went to the theater to see DreamWorks' Prince of Egypt.
Okay.
In theaters. And the score's by Hans Zimmer. A lot of people know Hans Zimmer for, other things he's written. He's done modern things like, he's done Inception, he's done Interstellar, but at that point, I just knew him for Prince of Egypt and Lion King in 1994. So, 95, I can't remember Lion King. But anyway, Lion King he did, and then he did Prince of Egypt as well. And that score was just something that was like grabbing me. And I was like, whatever I have to do to stand in front of that sound all the time is what I want to do.
Wow. That's a great story, and it's obviously so cool that you had this little self-exploratory approach toward, getting into finding out about classical music, classical instruments, violin. At the same time, the reality is African Americans don't seem to have a great connection mm-hmm. with classical music. Let's just explore that reality a little bit. I mean, you're nodding your head, so you're agreeing with me in that regard. Mm-hmm. What, I guess it's kind of a two-part thing. What do you see are the root causes? I think some of them are representation, obviously a big part of it, but also what might be lacking in classical music because we don't have more African Americans coming to it, finding their way to it.
Yeah, well, this is important for me to mention, so I'm going to mention this first before I go there. I became aware of that reality later than most African Americans going into classical music do. And the reason why is because my elementary school music teacher was African American. And that so it wasn't until I was like 12 or 13 that I really realized that I was like the only one in a lot of the circles I was in. My teacher in elementary school was African American. He always talked about two of his students so he also did a group on the side called Chicago Teen Ensemble. And two of the students that he taught that were also part of the teen ensemble, he always talked about them a lot. You know, they're siblings, they're fantastic. And I now, as a professional musician, have gotten the chance to meet both of them. And it's so crazy when I think about the pedigree I come from. So both of them in the classical music world are like universally known now. So, which is funny about it. And so they're the brothers, Damari and Anthony McGill. So Anthony McGill is currently principal clarinet at the New York Philharmonic. So Damari, I believe, is in Seattle as principal flute, but he's been in Seattle, he's been in Dallas, he's been in other places as well. But it's like to come from that pedigree is something that I don't take lightly.
Right.
And I'm just like, hopefully I can get to that level somewhere sometime soon. So, but having that experience at the beginning helped me some.
Okay.
It helped me from quitting before I had gotten a full taste. So that's part of it. That's part of the answer. If I had been introduced to the lack of black and brown folk in classical music at the beginning, I may have given up before I even got started. But the thing was, as I kept progressing forward, I was like, well, I really love this and I'm really discouraged, but I have to keep doing it because I really love it. How do I make this better? How do I make it easier? What's going on? And the thing that I'm realizing is there's this saying that's around now that's called saying the quiet part out loud. And so the quiet part that, you know, a lot of people don't want to say, and it's terrible. I would hazard a guess at 95. I'll call it 95%. 95% of the major orchestras in the United States are trying to be European orchestras of the last century.
Hmm.
In the way that they program and in the way that they present music. And when you look at programs for a lot of these large orchestras, I'm talking about large orchestras. So I'm, you know, your Seattle's, your Phillies, your New York Phils, Boston, LA, etc. When you look at a lot of these big orchestras, Cleveland, you look at their seasons, you know, where are the American composers? Where are the diverse American composers, you know? Where are the things by composers written after 1960? You know, there as I was coming up, you know, this is so funny. People would be like, "Oh, you know, Rite of Spring, that's like new music." Rite of Spring has been out for over 100 years at this point. can we not do that, please? but the crazy thing about it is if you go to Europe, especially in Germany, they're like going forward. Some of their orchestras over there are more adventurous in their programming than we are over here, which makes no sense.
Right.
Because they're the older tradition. I feel like at some point, somebody or some group of somebodies decided that in order for this art form to survive in the United States, it needed to mimic what it is over there, because that's where it started. instead of deciding that, why don't we make it our own thing so that it's supported here because we're supporting our communities. People don't seem to do that unless they are smaller orchestras. And I like to say they don't have a choice, but the reality of it is they make a choice to support their communities, to reflect their communities. A lot of the most diverse programming you will see in orchestras in the United States are orchestras where their yearly budget is under $2 million.
Hmm.
And that's terrible, because then you have these orchestras, you know, with budgets in like the 70s and 80s of million dollars range. And then you look at their programming and you're like, why can't you take a chance and reflect your community better? You know, the other issue that happens a lot too is in classical music, a lot of orchestral musicians treat orchestra, I shouldn't say orchestral musicians, it's not the musicians, a lot of orchestras, like administrations and things like that, treat it as sort of this shining city on a hill model. You know, let us bring the unwashed masses to the classical music. And the problem with that is you're basically telling other people that they're not cultured enough if they don't, you know, take part in your culture the way that you present it, which, you know, is not a way to get anyone to do anything for any reason. You know, what you need to do is say, okay, I am here. I represent, you know, a community of percentage of this, percentage of this, percentage of this, and this is how I'm going to program so that people feel that they see themselves reflected in what's going on. You know, the other thing too is that there's not enough emphasis on education at the lower level. There's not enough attempts to recruit. One of the things is, you know, there's a thing that I preach to people a lot, because some organizations say, you know, we've made orchestral auditions better because they're blind now. We have the curtain up for all rounds, the final round included, and now they're blind auditions. We have carpet, so if someone identifies as female and is wearing heels, we can't hear it, you know, if blah, 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 blah. And the thing that I tell them is, I'm like, you're trying to fix the problem way past when the problem happens. Like, if you're not trying to fix it at the educational level, at the base level of saying, you're welcome in this space, you know, we would love to have you in this space, creating complete blind auditions literally does nothing.
Right.
It's the same people that were there before. You just now can't see them. you're not actually treating the problem at the core. You're treating it at like this later stage where it shouldn't be treated.
Jamon Dunn-Danger is with us on What's Next. Jamon will be the conductor of Joshua's Boots, the opera by Adolphus Hale Stork. That's this Friday and Saturday, First Shiloh Baptist Church on Pine and Buffalo's East Side. We're going to come back with more with Jamon. As a matter of fact, if you like film music, you're interested in film scores, we're going to pick a little bit of Jamon's brain. This is a passion of his for sure, of Jamon's as well. And we'll have that conversation coming back right after this. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media produced a short documentary on creative restorations, which delivers life-saving supplies to combat overdose in Western New York.
Because we're a new agency, what happens sometimes is, you know, a lot of grant funders, they are hesitant to fund you. So we were on the fence with getting the grant before I sent them the video. It was able to show the grant funder what exactly their money was going to go towards. With that grant, that allowed us to secure a home base. Now we have a location where we do community meals, where we provide services right then and there. So I think the importance is you guys were able to really put boots on the ground with us, really show the city in a lens that you don't commonly see. So I think it helps to raise awareness to some of the issues that we have in our city. But also, what else left do we have to do as a community to better our community? Please, if you can, fund public media. Make sure that they're available, because they really put a harder focus on the community, and it really gives a better view of what we really need to get done here.
Contact Congress now at protectmypublicmedia.org.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of Stage Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
Your voice matters. Sign up to receive updates on threats to federal funding for public media at protectmypublicmedia.org. You can help safeguard the future of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thank you.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Back on What's Next with Jaman Dundanger. Coming up on Friday and Saturday, Jaman will be conducting the opera Joshua's Boots by Dr. Adolphus Hailstork at the First Shiloh Baptist Church here in Buffalo. Friday, 7:30, Saturday at 2:30. We'll hit on that before we say goodbye, but I definitely want to pick your brain a little bit here about film scores. we got into it just a little bit before we went on the air, and it is so fascinating because obviously, in some ways, when we think of film right off the bat, we're thinking visual. Mm-hmm. But that connection, that music that is inside, really does make or break a film for the most part.
Yeah, it really does. It's really funny. So I teach a class on this. It's called Music and Media at University of Buffalo, where I teach. And it's one of those things where when you go across time and you just look at how it changed. You know, the original versions of film music were literally organists just improvising night in and night out. You know, you had the organ in the studio, and then you started to try to sync things together. The Jazz Singer in 1927 was the first movie to have speaking sound effects and music all together in one film. And then it just kind of progressed from there. Sometimes you have, you know, composers like Miklos Rocha doing like these gigantic scores as he did for Ben-Hur, the original Ben-Hur movie. And then you sometimes have these minimalist scores where it's just, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's really important, though, because, you know, when people realize just the purpose that the music stands for, it's like, you know, here's a theme, you know, here's a theme here, here's a theme here. You know, John Williams is notorious for, you know, his thematic, you know, leitmotifs. Here's the theme that represents this, this represents that. You know, a fun story I love to tell, a fun tidbit I love to tell people. Steven Spielberg has directed 36 movies, I believe it is. Yeah, Steven Spielberg has directed 36 movies. Of those 36, John Williams has written scores for 31. Ugh. And the funny thing about that is he would have written scores for, I think, 33, except he had to pick which Steven Spielberg movie he would do because two of them were at the same time on two different occasions. So it's like, you know, it's these fun little things you learn too.
How long does it take John Williams to score a film? Any idea?
I really don't know. But something that connects film music to classical music that a lot of people don't know is there are things like there's something called a temp track. So in film, you know, you're shooting a scene, you're doing something. The director will say, "I've heard a piece of music that kind of is what I'm going for." Sends it to the composer and says, "I'm using this as a temp track for this scene." And then the composer goes, "Okay, whatever," you know. And then they'll write something similar to that temp track. For example, none of you will ever watch this the same way again. At the beginning of Home Alone, where they wake up and they realize they've slept in, okay, the first Home Alone, Catherine O'Hara and everybody's running around. Yep. The music there is called Holiday Flight, okay? Listen to that on the soundtrack. The temp track that they used before John wrote the music for it is actually the Trepak from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker.
Oh, wow.
So they used the Trepak from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker as the temp track while they filmed that. And then John said, "Okay, you want something like this? I'll write something similar." And then he wrote Holiday Flight for that scene. And then when you listen to the two, you'll hear the things that are similar between the two tracks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Greatest film score.
Oh God, there's no easy answer to this.
Something just flashed to mind. Come on.
Oh God, yeah, it's. I think about all of John's stuff. It's just, it's so good.
All right, so non John Williams.
Yeah, non John Williams, right? Okay. Wow. Here, I'll tell you this. Go listen to the score to The Incredibles, the first Incredibles movie. By Michael Giacchino, okay, and listen to Wayne Bergeron put on a clinic on how to play high jazz trumpet, and then listen to the score, John Powell's score for the first animated How to Train Your Dragon. It will blow you away.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What about for your students? They must really love this. I got to believe this has got to be a big time elective for some of you to even get into the class.
Oh yeah, it's a great class, and the fact that I go over TV shows, you know, how Johnny Carson is who started, you know, the presence of bands on the Tonight shows. Those didn't exist before Johnny Carson. You know, and then we do other TV shows, how TV shows have become more cinematic, like Game of Thrones, and then we go into video games, how it goes from at the beginning, you had to be a programmer to be able to write music for video games because it was chiptune, and now, because they can compress the audio, you have these full-fledged composers just writing full scores for these games. People like Jeremy Soule, you know, you have Koji Kondo writing, you know, the Legend of Zelda series, and then it's just such a huge world, such a huge world.
And for you, it's kind of maybe a personal goal of sorts to be able to do this kind of thing?
Yeah.
You have something in mind already, do you? Or just, I've got to wait till I have the work in front of me, and then I can do it. Or do you got some ideas already?
I mean, I'm before the work is concerned, I'm just waiting for a call. Somebody just call me and just say, hey, we know you really want to do this. And I'm going to be like, when is the next plane leave? I will come to wherever you are.
Wow. That's exciting just to consider that. It really is. It's great. So we started, of course, talking about Joshua's Boots. It's Friday and Saturday at First Shiloh. I'm just going to go out on a limb. The acoustics must be terrific.
Yeah, actually, believe it or not, a lot of people, you know, don't really know how to deal with acoustics in churches, but it actually sounds really, really good in there.
Yeah.
So it's very good in there. Yeah. We started our first rehearsal in the space last night. So it's, it's fantastic.
Noah, you didn't have to make any adaptations. Everything can do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. You can hear everything you need to hear when you need to hear it.
Right.
That way.
You'll make sure of it. Yeah, the conductor will make sure of it. And at the same time, we didn't talk about this, but Dr. Hale Stork will be in town this weekend. Yes.
Yes, he is. The BPO and Joanne Folletta are doing his saxophone concerto with Tim McAllister. And so I was in contact with him, as I am still in contact with him, and he said, hey, you know, when is this opera? And I told him, and he said, well, I might have time to stop by. So we're looking forward to him possibly being there. I'm not going to tell you which day.
Okay.
So just come to both, and then maybe you'll see him.
How about then for conductor, any sense of a different pressure or vibe for you to have the composer in there with you?
If I didn't know him at all, possibly.
Okay.
But the fact that I know him and the fact that he knows how I approach his music, a lot of that doesn't really like bother me because I know I just need to be myself. But even if I didn't know the composer, I know, same thing. Just be yourself. Just do what you believe the composer is asking you to do. And then, you know, it's a conversation afterwards.
And let's make sure that we have all the specifics. So I did mention it's Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 2:30.
Mm-hmm.
Same time, we know classical music, opera can be a little...
This opera is actually shorter.
Oh,
so this,
interesting.
This is a shorter opera.
We may have been burying the lead here.
Yeah, right. so this is a shorter opera. It's one act, a prologue, and five scenes. It's about... So the runtime, if you do everything a little too fast, is about 55 minutes. But if you do everything in about a reasonably paced, it's about, at most, an hour and 15.
Okay.
So it's not... You know, some operas go for 3 hours, some go for 2.5. This is only an hour and 15. So if you think to, like, allow yourself 90 minutes for the entire experience of getting there, seeing the opera, leaving. Yeah, it'll be right about on there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how is it when you're all said and done? The composers or the conductors all said and done? How do you feel?
I feel great, but, you know, it's like such a long process to get to the performance. Sure. You kind of need to take a day to just decompress, you know, because you're still kind of, you know, you have that adrenaline hype the day after. And so you just kind of, you know, just kind of go on a walk, you know, go on a drive, do something that brings you sort of peaceful joy. And then on to the next thing.
On to the next thing. Well, we're looking forward to finding out what that next thing is. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us this hour.
Thank you. It's been fantastic being here. Thank you.
Jamon Dundanger will be the conductor for Joshua's Boots, the performance of the music put together, the opera put together by Dr. Adolphus Hale Stork. And it's going to be Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 2:30 at First Shiloh Church here in Buffalo. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.